Get used to this. Wednesdays is going to be your day with Hub at this time. 312-644-6767. Got a couple lines open if you want to jump on. You got something good, Hub will be available to you. Hub, hello.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
We're doing very well. Are you prepared for your peeps?
I am ready.
Good. So is Mark in Algonquin on the score. Fire away, Mark.
Hey, guys. Hub, what is your level of concern with Mitchell Trubisky's ability to process information at the NFL level as an elite QB? Because there's been several instances where he's not been able to come off his first or second receiver and find an open receiver, and he scrambles around and doesn't really make much happen. So what's your level of concern here with him to be able to do that?
You know, Mark, I have a little bit of concern. I had a little bit of concern the day they drafted him, and I really don't put any stock in what happened in the 12 starts last year, because that really was not a well-formed NFL offense or scheme or plan. I think things were changing from week to week. I think that this past offseason and preseason with Matt Nagy and Brad Childress and Mark Helfrich, you know, should have been a really good start for him. I did not expect him to be a finished product or play his best football game Sunday night in Lambeau. So I know it's frustrating for fans, but there's no way I am coming off, at least for the next 4, 5, 6, 7 weeks. All I'm looking for right now is improvement from week to week. I will say that after, you know, getting to really study that tape from Sunday, he's not seeing things, and I don't know that it is so much not being able to come off one read and go to another. It's just that right now the game is still moving too fast for him, and we know this happens with everybody who comes into the league. And I don't want to get too long-winded here, but guys, because I was listening a little bit this morning on my way into the office, you know, people can talk all they want about the other guys. I mean, if you look at Sam Darnold's numbers, they weren't that good. He scored. You know, he made some nice throws, but it's not like he was, you know, Brady esque or Rodgers esque. You know, now you're going to get Josh Allen starting. We'll see what he does. Patrick Mahomes had a huge game. I want to see him do it 4, 5, 6 times in a row. Let's not waste time comparing, you know, Trubisky to the other young quarterbacks. Let's just look for improvement from week to week. And I think it may even bother me more than Dan. Please stop putting the damn N in his name, because it's not there.
Here is Frank in Oak Park with Hub on the score.
Hub, I want to tap into what you're hearing from your sources across the country on something with impact to both game pickers and fantasy players. After 1 week, Buffalo appears to have the worst offensive line in the league. Last year's starters, Eric Wood and Richie Incognito, are retired and into mental ward, respectively. Former marginal Bears starters Jordan Mills and Vladimir Dukas are now forced into leadership roles. As a result, Bill QBs and running backs face career-threatening injuries from the dozens and dozens of lookout blocks and blow-ups that await them on the schedule. But what other deficient blocking units in this league stand ready to destroy fan dreams in 2018?
Well, Frank, you're going to see one Monday night. It's the Seattle Seahawks. It's been a problem there forever. I think the stunning thing to me about Buffalo, it's not how bad they are on the offensive line. We knew that. And they knew that Eric Wood, it was actually an injury neck that forced him into an early retirement. They knew, you know, Richie Cognito was always one step away from the crazy house. And then they went and traded Cordy Glenn, who's a pretty good left tackle, to the Bengals. So this is a team that broke a 22-year playoff drought and then decided to rebuild, you know, which I guess is fine. And you've got a second-year GM and head coach. They're not in any jeopardy right now. But you know, I've been, not just me, I mean, most analysts have said since June they have a chance to be, you know, one of the worst teams in the NFL. I think the other places where you got to look, as I said, Seattle, this kid, Jermaine Ifedi, they used a high pick on him, and they're still letting him play right tackle. I don't understand it. Maybe it's because Russell Wilson is more elusive, but look at the beating he took in Denver. He's going to take another beating Monday night. Cincinnati is much improved with Cordy Glenn, but they're still trying to play a couple of their young people who haven't come through. I think off what you saw, guys, yes, they figured it out in the second half.
But I think a lot of people are missing the bigger storyline with the Packers is if you get Rodgers back out there, the interior of that offensive line, there's nothing to get excited about there. And you never know when those tackles are going to get injured. So, you know, if I'm a Packer fan, I'd be keeping a very close eye on that going forward. The other team that quite frankly, it's interesting, is the Rams, maybe, you know, one of the three best, maybe they're the best team in the NFL right now, but they're one injury away from having real problems on the offensive line, too.
This segment with Hub Arkish is brought to you by Subway. Check out three flavors to savor with delicious signature wraps only at Subway restaurants. Limited time only at participating restaurants. And the top of the hour is brought to you by the Chicago Wolves. Tickets for the Chicago Wolves 25th anniversary season are on sale now at Ticketmaster.com. Be there for the home opener as the Wolves defend their back-to-back Central Division championships on October 13th at Allstate Arena. Here's another Frank. He is in Lakeview, and he is on the Score with Hub.
Yeah, hi. First of all, I have to make my voice way more distinctive to compete with Frank from Oak Park. But I never know when you're going to be on, Hub, but I'm always like, I listen all the time, but I never hear that you're going to be on. And whenever you're on, I'm like, oh, wow, wait, great. My problem is with Aaron Lynch. It seemed like from the very beginning, Aaron Lynch was having problems. And I don't, you know, I'm not saying he cost the game or anything like that. But do you see Aaron Lynch getting better, or is there, like, what, you know, what's the long-term plan there?
Frank, well, one other quick, I forgot an important one for our last, Frank. The Vikings are another offensive line to keep an eye on because that's the only thing that keeps them from being the best team in the NFL. I looked up, and when Aaron Lynch started, because he did start, he was out there for the first snap across from Leonard Floyd. Now, I understood they didn't want to run Khalil Mack out there on the opening play, but I would have expected Isaiah Irving. I might have expected Sam Acho. I was really surprised when it was Aaron Lynch. I understand the fascination with him. Go back and watch the tape of his rookie year under Fangio with an uber-talented linebacking core like the Bears now appear to have as well. I get why they think he can be a piece. But having literally not practiced during the preseason and had his first couple practices leading up to this game, I just didn't expect him to be the guy that was going to be the choice as the number, basically the number three pass rusher. He didn't show anything. Maybe it's because he's not in game shape. He is uniquely talented, and he's a bit of a head case. And so obviously the Bears feel that, you know, it was Vic Fangio who got his best football out of him back in his rookie year 4 years ago. I'm sure Vic is stumping for him and thinks he can get it out of him again. But we need to see something fairly soon because I didn't see anything in the tape Sunday night to suggest he should have been out there.
It's Hub Arkish here on the Bernstein and McKnight Show. And for Frank in Lakeview or anyone listening to the show, Hub's part of our Bears coverage every Wednesday and Thursday. Wednesday, he's yours. Thursday, he's ours. You can catch him here at this same time. Next up for Hub is Paul in Orland Park. What's up, Paul?
Hey, guys. So since the loss, all I've been hearing critically is about a rookie coach being, you know, kind of not up to snuff and a new quarterback not being up to snuff. And whenever I hear a game where Team X blows a big first-point lead to Team Y, the first thing that I think of is, well, the defense fell apart. And that what really bothered me about that game is that not that the They did get 23 points in the game. They didn't adjust to basically the one-legged pirate Aaron Rodgers in the second half defensively, who was just doing one-step drops and 3 5-yard passes. And I saw no adjustments from Vic Fangio, who's supposed to be the experienced seasoned coach with a top 10 defense last year and probably improved this year, right? So is there any conversation about Vic Fangio's poor adjustments on that?
Well, Paul, there were subtle adjustments, and this is where, you know, you have to become a bit of a student. They went back and forth in coverages and 30 fronts and 40 fronts. And at the end of the day, there's three or four quarterbacks in the league. Rodgers is one of them. There's a debate as to whether he or Brady is the best. Along with them, you can plug in Drew Brees. Some people would plug in Phillip Rivers, playing at home with a full complement, maybe Ben Roethlisberger. Any one of those guys who are going to take one step and get the ball out, There's no adjustment for that, okay? I mean, you know, what you can do is come up and play press, and you can start bumping. But when you've got a 20-point lead, that is the exact opposite of what you would normally do, you know, because you're leaving yourself open to the big risk, the big hit. And sure enough, it happened on the play that Geronimo Allison caught the 51-yard touchdown pass. Kyle Fuller actually had great coverage there, but he didn't make the play in the end. No excuse for Kyle, you know, dropping the interception, for Allison catching the ball. There's no what ifs coming. He's got to make those plays. But it, you know, you've heard the cliche, it's a game of inches, and so, you know, really, I didn't think the defense was that bad in the second half. The Randall Cobb touchdown is a broken play. You know, Eddie Jackson will learn he cannot leave his feet in that situation. So, you know, maybe there's a couple other things Fangio could have done, but amongst the reasons that the Bears lost that game, I don't have, you know, poor coaching by Vic Fangio on my top four or five.
Next up in Appleton, this is Al. He's on the score with Hub.
Yeah, hi, Hub. The question I have for you is this. In the fourth quarter, when the Bears were down either in the red zone or near the red zone, it was third and one, I believe, and they went for the touchdown pass rather than just getting the first down. Am I incorrect? It was only a yard to go, and why didn't they just run the ball? And then if they had to kick the field goal, they could have kicked the field goal.
Yeah, there was three different instances in the second half where they were third and short, third and one, or third and two, and in each case they took Jordan Howard off the football field. And I thought that was a terrible overreaction to the one play in the first half, where I guess it was fourth and one and a half, and Kenny Clark just destroyed Cody Whitehair and stuffed Jordan Howard, and they turned the ball over. You know, much like, again, it's not what people want to hear, but much like there has to be some patience with Mitch Trubisky, there does have to be some patience with Matt Nagy. That was his first game as a head coach. I understand he wants to call his own plays, but at some point he's going to remember that Andy Reid did too, until he handed the play calling over to Matt Nagy. And so I think we're going to see Matt calling his own plays all season, but I think there also has to be you know, some compromise in which he turns some things over to Mark Helfrich so he can concentrate on his bigger job, which is being the head coach and making decisions, you know, what to do on fourth down, thinking two plays ahead. I'm not sure, you know, I guess some play callers would argue they're always thinking two or three plays ahead, but in these third and shorts in a game situation, I'm not sure he was able to completely do his job. And he himself came out and said that, you know, he made some bad choices on those play calls.
In Arlington Heights, it's Ken. He's on the score with Hub.
Hub, next to NFL football, I love you and I love your perspective. I love when you're on.
Thank you, Ken.
I was up at the 49ers-Vikings game this last weekend. I'm a big Jimmy G fan. You saw him play in high school, saw him all through college, I saw him for 8 years. And he's run a hurry-up offense from high school. Why is it when you get to the pros, he can't run a hurry-up offense? That's his specialty, a two-second drop back and a pass, and he's a lightning bolt. And he gets to the pros, and they don't do it. Is there a reason?
Well, Ken, you want him to do it 60 minutes? Is that what you're saying? You want him to do it the whole game? Or?
Yeah, we'll assume he is.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons is because you'll destroy everybody else on your team. I mean, you can't play racehorse football all day long. You know, even you go back to the K-Gun and the Buffalo Bills, you know, back in the 90s, they went to four straight Super Bowls. It was no huddle, but they'd spend 20, 25 seconds at the line of scrimmage. So, you know, when you talk about running a hurry-up offense, you know, just by going, you know, sugar huddle or no huddle, you can knock out the substitutions. You can get the other, you know, the defense from getting too comfortable. But if you're trying to literally run 10 plays in 2 minutes or a minute 40, which is what the hurry up is, it's just, it's a very dangerous way to play football. And I got to tell you, I didn't get to watch the whole game. Obviously, we're all over the place on NFL Sunday, but I saw chunks of it. I was really impressed with how tough Garoppolo and the 49ers did play the Vikings on Sunday in Minnesota, maybe the best team in the league in a home opener. And it wasn't the lack of a hurry-up offense that beat him. It was the two picks he threw. You know, they were very costly. And again, I love Jimmy Garoppolo. I think he's going to be really good. But that was his, eighth NFL start. And so, you know, it may be that once he has more experience, once he is a seasoned veteran with a couple years' worth of starts, they'll run more hurry-up. But you don't see anybody in the NFL who does that for 60 minutes.
Hub Arkish is here. He is going to be here for another segment taking your phone calls. So I urge you to dial in and be part of our second phone bank here at 312-644-6767. We will clear them all out and fill them all back up, and we will all know more about the Bears and the NFL. So keep it right here. Bernstein and McKnight with Hub on the Score.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Talking football with Hub Arkish, as we do on Wednesdays and Thursdays. He belongs to you today, and therefore we are lining up your phone calls. We have two, three lines open at 312-644-6767. So we continue. Next up is Steve in Glen Ellen. He's on Sports Radio 670. Fire away, Steve.
Hey, guys. Hub, I had a quick question, and I'm not second-guessing or criticizing Fangio at all. But during the critical stretch of the game against Packers, I'm pretty sure he dropped Mack and Floyd in the coverage. They weren't rushing Rodgers. And I'm just trying to understand, why did he do that?
Not criticizing or second-guessing, but just kind of second-guessing a little bit.
Well, yeah, and Steve, please understand, you can criticize him and second-guess him all you want. That's the joy of being a fan. And I'm sure there are times when I do also. But I think in this particular case, what you're talking about is basically a prevent defense. Rush 3, drop 8. They were sending 3 and sometimes 4 in those situations. One of the advantages that the Bears believe they have, particularly in Roquan Smith and Danny Trevathan, but also in Leonard Floyd and Khalil Mack, is that these guys are all athletic enough to play in coverage. And when you look at the top pass rushers around the NFL, most of them are purely pass rushers. And so if you drop, let's say, Mack and Floyd, maybe even on the same play, but you've got an Akeem Hicks or a Roy Robertson-Harris or, you know, maybe an Isaiah Irving or an Aaron Lynch is on the field, that they think is going to be one of the advantages they have. Now, in this particular game, again, you're talking about a 20-0 lead. Maybe it was 20-7 or whatever at that point, but it's very common around the NFL to play prevent. You drop 8, you rush 3, and that's what they were doing. And if, in fact, you're talking about a play where he dropped both Mack and Floyd, then I'd have to go back and look at the tape, but I almost bet that they probably sent a safety or maybe they sent one of the other linebackers. All they're trying to do is mix it up, have the 8 guys for Rodgers to throw in, but still try and hope that one of those 3 rushers comes free.
Yeah, I want to echo Hub, too. There is absolutely no apology needed for questioning or second-guessing. That is the purpose of what we do here.
Yes, that is the point.
Yes, that's exactly the point, so feel free to do that. In Geneva, this is Sean on the Score.
Hey, Hub, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, Sean.
After watching the Raiders debacle on Monday night, I have 2 questions. One, is there any salvaging Derek Carr, who seems to get worse every year? Or should I be looking at Tua Tagovailoa in next year's draft? And number 2, with John Gruden revamping the roster, making it now the oldest roster in the league, how bad is this going to get? Is this going to be Bills bad? Thanks. Have a good day.
Well, Sean, I mean, obviously, you missed the memo. John Gruden is God's gift to quarterbacking. So, you know, Derek Carr should be fine. And it was ugly. I get it. They have not really given him great receivers to work with. Amari Cooper is good, but has never been the pro I thought he was going to be. They don't have much else to work with now. That offensive line is aging. You know, in all seriousness, I'm not a big John Gruden fan, but I think he does know quarterbacking, and I would not write off Derek Carr. You know, one of the things that happens around the league, and you got to keep a close eye on this, is 2 years ago when the Raiders were 12-4, they won 6 of those those 12 games by less than 6 points. And so, you know, those are games that, that easily can go either way. And so even if you're just talking about three of them going the other way, now you're a 9-7 football team. They were never as good, and Derek Carr was probably never as good at that point as we thought he was going to be. I've been impressed with the young man. Gruden does know quarterbacking. Unfortunately, with what he's doing to the rest of that roster, I think Carr is going to struggle for a while. And if it wasn't clear before, it wasn't clear because I didn't expect this, but it's pretty clear now. What they're doing is they're saying, we're building for Vegas. You know, we're a lame duck here in Oakland anyway. We're probably not going to sell any more or any less tickets. We're probably going to get booed anyway since we're leaving. So they're almost doing an NFL version of tanking with a team that nobody thought was ready to tank. But there's no other way that I can look at it. You know, they had the extra first-round picks. I mean, you saw it Sunday night. It's absurd to trade a guy like Khalil Mack because he, 2 years from now, would still be just 29 and a defensive MVP. But clearly, to me anyway, they're kind of trying to be bad right now, and Derek Carr is going to pay the price for that.
The bottom of the hour is brought to you by the Chicago Wolves. Tickets for the Chicago Wolves 25th anniversary season are on sale now at Ticketmaster.com. Be there for the home opener as the Wolves defend their back-to-back Central Division championships on October 13th at Allstate Arena. Here is Mark. He's in Vernon Hills, and he's on the Score.
Hi, I wanted to ask about the Trubisky play where he was scrambling out of the pocket, and Tariq Cohen was right in front of him. And the Green Bay Packer linebacker was standing right next to Cohen. And he didn't tell Cohen to move to the side to go back a little bit. He could have floated a pass over the linebacker. He could have run an extra 4 yards if Tariq Cohen had moved off to the side. But the linebacker was covering both players at the same time because neither one knew what to do.
Well, again, I'm not going to debate you on it. That's your interpretation of it. When you say he didn't tell them, they're not in a position to be having conversations out there. We'll see quarterbacks motioning with their hands, trying to get their receivers to come back or go deep, something like that. It's really hard for me, Mark. Without having at least a picture in front of me or knowing the exact play we're talking about, it gets back to, I think, our very first caller, though. Mitch Trubisky is still at the stage of his development where he's not seeing things out there, and it's because the game is moving a little fast for him. And it sounds like that might have been one of those plays. It is also quite possible that Tariq Cohen, who is very young, was somewhere he shouldn't have been on the football field. So when we get to specific plays like that, I can't say for certain without at least being able to take a look at it and give you a better answer than that.
All right, real quick, let's squeeze in Bob in Cedar Lake. You're on the Score, Bob.
Hey, Hub, how are you?
Good, Bob.
You commented, Hub, that you definitely didn't list Fangio is one of the reasons for the Bears' loss, but just as the offense played not to lose, so did the defense. Hub, they won with that three-man rush. They were playing soft. They weren't coming with the rush like they did in the first half, and I think the blame falls just as squarely on his shoulders as the head coach. Go ahead, Hub.
Bob, I respect your opinion. I don't know what else to tell you. I think that Fangio did what is tried and true and tested in the NFL. It works the great majority of the time. I just was in a meeting on another subject, but there were Bears fans and they were kind of bemoaning the thing. And I said, guys, let's call this what it was. It was possibly the worst loss in the 99-year history of the Chicago Bears. It's going to sting. It's painful. And you can blame anybody you want, but at the end of the day, when you blow a 20-point lead in the second half to try and, hang that on a coach who didn't have the ability to go out on the field and make a play, who believes and has had great success in what he believes, that he was putting people in a position to win, I struggle to agree with that. I thought that on the offensive side of the ball, again, not play calling in general, but with those three specific third and shorts that could have extended the Bears' possession and run the clock out on the Packers, I fault the choices. I debate the choices that Matt Nagy made. I know that in terms of the game that Vic Fangio called, had he called an all-out blitz and somebody not gotten mm-hmm. there, and you had a receiver running free for the winning score, you'd be
as angry or more angry with him than you are right now. The Bears did not play the defenses that he called correctly. Again, Eddie Jackson can't leave his feet. Kyle Fuller has to catch an interception. You know, we're having a different conversation as to what went wrong on defense as opposed to what went wrong on offense.
Hub, we'll talk tomorrow at noon.
All right, guys, take care.
Hub Arkish brought to you by Timeshare Exit Team, another summer you couldn't use your timeshare. If it's no longer working for you and you need out, call Timeshare Exit Team, 844-915-EXIT, 844-915-EXIT, or visit timeshareexitteam.com. If you missed Theo Epstein's appearance, stick around if you want to hear it again. There's a lot in there because Theo has the latest on the Cubs and their discussions with MLB about what's going on with his hurricane and the makeup game and a lot more about last night and this year's team. You've got the score.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
Near the start of the show, we talked to Cubs President of Baseball Operations Theo Epstein at a very interesting time for his team. And the first question, and a brilliant one it was, what's up with Jose Quintana and all that? How about that?
That was a huge performance for us. I think he turned a corner, you know, about 3-4 starts ago with a really small mechanical adjustment, just to help him stay over the rubber and get online a little bit more. And you see his fastball's ticked up a mile or two per hour, and he's got much better finish on his heater. And that's really everything. I mean, the guy battled all year without his best fastball. And now that he's had it, he can be himself. And really picked us up last night in the last 3 or 4 starts, honestly. It was an outstanding performance. We needed it the most.
Theo, we were talking about this in the pre-show meeting. I'm looking at the Brooks baseball stuff. The fastball's up. The change is up. The curve is up in velocity. His delivery itself seems so simple. So how minute is this mechanical change to find that kind of return? It's mind-boggling if you're not in the game like you are, I'd imagine, to see that kind of small change meet those kind of results.
Yeah, it's amazing how the smallest thing, and it doesn't always have to be about, you know, the arm action or the takeaway or anything with your upper half. Sometimes it can be something as small as a real slight adjustment with the lower half or foot placement. And, you know, it's the kinetic chain, it's all connected. So what you do early in your delivery can affect where your arm is upon release. And He does have a simple, repeatable delivery. It's one of the things that's made him so good and so consistent, but it doesn't mean that you're going to have it locked in all the time. And sometimes it takes just a little bit of a feel with an adjustment to get back in sequence. And it's all about his heater and the finish on it. It sets everything else up. And now that he has that back, we're really, really confident in him.
Scoring runs of late in run scoring situations has really not been easy for the Cubs. And generally, when I look at performance with runners in scoring position, it all seems like statistical noise that hitters are who they are and given enough time and enough situations, that's just the case. However, it's been 2 years now that the Cubs have underperformed relative to who they are when it comes to runners in scoring position, whether it's Chris Bryant or Wilson Contreras. You know, it's a thing that's occurring again this year. Does that merit attention? Is there reason to think there's something causal, or is that just a blip?
No, it definitely merits attention because it's not just pure, randomness and sample. I mean, over time, these things do regress and your performance situationally will start to mirror your overall performance, but there's more to it than that, and it's really approach based, especially when you look at team wide trends and strikeout rates, walk rates, hard hit rates, ground ball rates in those situations. We haven't really locked in a great approach consistently. We've had our stretches, and that's when we've played our best baseball. Honestly, is when we're making hot contact and good contact, using the whole field in those situations. Our power is dramatically down with runners on base and runners in scoring position. So that's really been the story beyond just the runners in scoring position. The second half of the year, or especially, you know, August 1st on, we just haven't driven the ball with any consistency throughout the lineup. And if you think back to the trade deadline, you know, we had more bats than we had spots in the lineup, and we were solely focused on on pitching because we really didn't have anywhere to play anybody. And then right away, our offense really kind of stumbled in August. We went out and got Daniel Murphy to try to right the ship, and we did. But we just haven't really clicked yet, August and September offensively. I'd like to think that means it's around the corner because we're just too talented to stay like this and not drive the ball. But we're having to try to find ways to win without driving the baseball, and that's tough to do.
So is that something you don't fight? Because fans are going to say, as things get close and late, play a little more small ball, take some risks, send Ben Zobrist on an 0-2 count with Javi Baez up there knowing you're going to get a breaking ball, that kind of stuff. Is that something that you and Jed and Joe work together to come up with creative solutions? Or is that something that's too much of a, break glass in case of emergency and sounding a panic alarm this late in the season?
No, you have to be realistic. Everything's on the table. When you get down to 3 weeks left in the season and this tighter race, you do everything you can to win the game. That's why I said it doesn't matter if you've been in a slump. It doesn't matter if you're not feeling great. It's sort of all hands on deck to win these ball games, and that includes Joe and trying to create optimal strategies with who we are right now and what we are right now. And the best solution is just to get guys going and clicking offensively, and I think it will happen. Typically the way these things work is two or three guys get hot, and you ride those guys to some big innings and score a bunch of runs. But until that happens, of course you given the personnel and given the game situation, you get a little bit more aggressive to try to score, even just one run, especially with how good our starting pitching's been lately.
Jim Hickey on the Scores Morning Show today said that Brandon Morrow is looking ready for a sim game and then could return to the active roster shortly thereafter. Is that as you understand it?
Yeah, he's going to have one more 10 session and then a sim game, and then conceivably sometime next week could be available to us. And, we have to be prepared for a broad range of outcomes with him. We may not necessarily see his top shelf stuff. We may, but we may not. But I think he throws so hard that even him not quite locked in and not quite at his best could still help us. And he's really eager to get back and contribute, and give him a ton of credit for battling through this stuff. And I think there's a decent chance that he's going to help us. If he can work his way back towards the end of the game, we'll see if that happens or not. But it just creates so many more weapons for us and gives Joe a chance to be more aggressive with other guys and with Stropey coming in certain spots earlier in the game. So Brandon would certainly be welcome back.
So it sounds like he's not immediately returning to closer regardless.
Well, Joe's already said that, that he's, it would be foolish to his first game back throw him into a closing situation. That we'd obviously look for a lower leverage spot just to let him get out there and test it, because there's no minor league season left, so he can't throw a rehab game. So you want to, if possible, give him that first opportunity. We can go out and get himself comfortable in a situation where the game's not on the line.
What about Hayward?
Yeah, he said he was feeling good yesterday, making some progress. So he's in a running progression and throwing and hitting. So I don't know. I don't want to put a timetable on it, but sometime next week we'll have a chance to see him on the field. It'd be nice.
With Morrow then, just so I want to make sure I'm thinking about him the right way, I guess. And obviously things can change with a pen and a sim game and see how he feels, but will he essentially or kind of be a gas tank that you guys might not be able to refill once you start using it?
I don't know what you mean by that.
That once you start, using him, days off during the season or during a playoff run might not necessarily have him bounce back the way a healthy pitcher would, or he would when he's healthy.
I don't know that we know that yet.
Okay.
I think he's gonna. I don't think we would back to back him immediately, or maybe not at all during the regular season. But the first step is just getting him back and seeing how he feels and how he throws and how much he can help us, and then how available he is. So we're not getting ahead of ourselves, but I don't look at it that way. Again, I said there's a broad range of outcomes from him just not feeling good enough to get back and pitch effectively in game situations, to him being his normal self to somewhere in between, and we'll just kind of assess it as we go. But he feels good right now.
Theo, how can Major League Baseball reasonably ask you to put employees of the Cubs, your entire traveling party, on an airplane and send them toward a massive generational hurricane? Just that simply, how can reasonable people think that this is the right thing to do?
Well, we've certainly been making that argument strongly. I think the counter argument is that the storm has veered a little bit south, and that DC may not be dramatically affected tomorrow, and that more time is required to see exactly what the forecast is before we make that decision. But I cannot imagine that Major League Baseball would send us into a situation. Well, I know they would not send us into a situation where there's any danger or risk, hard stop. And then I cannot imagine that they send us into a situation where there's a chance of rain. You know, given what we experienced in Washington last weekend, and given the fact that that would create a situation of 30 straight days with a game scheduled in the middle of a pennant race, which is just about unprecedented. So, you know, to repeat, you know, they will not send us into a situation where there's any danger, and I cannot imagine they'd send us into a situation where there's rain. We'll see what happens.
Would you ever get to a point where you would simply say, listen, we are not going, and if you want to the extent that you want to punish us or forfeit a game, I mean, could you say it is in the best interest of the health and welfare of our players, of our entire traveling party, that we're simply not going? Figure out what you want to do.
Well, it's premature to say that. I think the first step is wait and see what the decision is, and we're all counting on common sense to rule the day. If we get into that position, there will certainly be a conversation with our players to talk about what the right thing to do is. And, Major League Baseball won't send our players into a situation that's dangerous, and we certainly wouldn't either. So absolutely there will be a conversation with our players before we determine what to do. But right now we're in a wait-and-see mode, just hoping for a common-sense solution.
Do you know when we'll know for sure?
No.
Joe mentioned the other day that he'd just as soon play the 163 after the season is over. We talked with Crane Kenny the other day as well, and he mentioned the idea of a neutral site game, like the clock is kind of running out on that. Are those kind of the senses that you have too, rather play 163 and the options for a neutral site?
Yeah,
just kind of aren't there?
Our position is that the game should be played the day after the season, just because of the burden of 30 consecutive days with a game scheduled, and the risk of flying in for a one-off where there's the possibility of a rain delay given what we just went through in D.C. But that's not the rule, and that's not the way it's being enforced right now. So now we're just in discussions with Major League Baseball awaiting their decision about the forecast and trying to make our case that it's unreasonable to ask this group of players to go 30 straight days with a game scheduled and possibly fly back to Washington to sit in a rain delay once again, given night game tonight and day game on Friday.
Something I've been meaning to ask you, we've had an ongoing conversation on this show regarding pitching and Major League Baseball and how to plan for all of the vicissitudes of pitching and what happens to arms. The idea that the experience that you've gone through this year with Darvish and with Chatwood and with Morrow, and then we saw what happened on the south side with Michael Kopech and all the fanfare, and then of course he needs Tommy John surgery. I mean, meaning to ask you, if you were doing it all over again, not necessarily the Cubs, but right now you are put in charge of Team X, full rebuild, is it still your belief that the right way to do it is to use draft capital and early resources more for position players and still to buy pitching when you need it? Does that still hold?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you build and plan around position players because there's more certainty. And the best thing you can do with pitching is make no long-term plans, because there's no such thing as long-term plans with pitching. So if you can, sometimes you get put in a situation where you have to, but if you can avoid making any long-term plans, it, it, it can pay off in the long run. So we decided to build a core of position players that we could win with for the 7 years they're going to be up here at a minimum, and then address the pitching on a shorter-term basis year to year when you have a better idea of who's good and who's not and who's healthy and who's not. And, you know, there we knew it would come with some risk year to year that we wouldn't figure it out perfectly every year, and we haven't. But, you know, look, this is the first year where we've really had serious pitching issues. If you look from, I think we led all of baseball, or certainly the National League, we led in ERA from 2015 through 2017. Addressing it year to year, or with shorter term plans, I guess is a better way to say it. And then even this year, with the troubles that we had with the offseason additions, we were able to make in-season adjustments with Hamels and with Chavez and figuring guys out. And our pitching projection, our pitching performance is a lot closer to our projection than our offensive performance, you know? So we've been able to figure the pitching out on the fly. So absolutely, I think the way to win, you know, over 162 and win championships and by getting in every year or just about every year is by building around more certainty. And that comes in the form of, you know, two-way position players with strong makeup.
So is it fair to say then with as many solutions, potentially long-term solutions, as you do have in pitching with Darvish and Quintana and Lester and the potential of, you know, locking Hendricks up, I suppose, Hamels option, that you're going to look for more, you may be looking for more flexibility come the offseason? Or is that not, it's just too early to say, I guess?
I think every team, every year in the offseason looks to add to its pitching staff and looks for reinforcements, because guys who a year previous had been healthy are no longer healthy, or guys who had been consistent performers going into the year have had down years, and you're unsure about what you're projecting going forward. I think you're always looking to add, and you never have enough. And but I guess my point is, when you're making, you know, a first round pick in 2013 trying to win a World Series in 2016 or 2018 or 2020, I think you have a little bit better feel what you're getting with a position player than with a pitcher. It doesn't mean pitching is not important. It doesn't mean, you know, the Mets beat us with, outstanding pitching, all healthy and all locked in at the same moment in time in the 2015 NLCS, and we tip our cap to that. And we took a lot of grief for that. And everyone said you have to build around young pitching, and we just kind of held our tongue. And the point was that I think over time, we like the odds in our favor better with our approach. And, you know, we've been to three straight NLCSs and won a championship, and hopefully we get in for a fourth straight year. And I think it's, you know, just because in general it's just harder to keep that pitching healthy and effective at the same time. And with the position player group, it's not like you're going to get perfect performance every year. You know, we've had a number of guys not perform up to expectations this year, but we're deep enough we've been deep enough and healthy enough and talented enough to, you know, to at the moment have the best record in the National League and certainly play ourselves into a place of contention. So we like that approach. It doesn't mean it's right for everyone, but it's been good for us.
That was Cubs President of Baseball Operations, Theo Epstein. Coming up next, we are going to say good afternoon to Dan McNeil and Danny Parkins as we send it out to Gallagher Way. They are out of the ballpark, so we'll say hello to them next on The Score.